Take a network break. Hey, Packet Pusher's virtual donut production will not be affected by coronavirus, so no need to pre-stock your flu bunker. Join us for our weekly analysis of tech news. We've got some stories coming up on Fortinet, VMware, and lots of financial results. But first, a little business for us. Today's show is sponsored by ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes gives you performance visibility from every user to every app over any network, internal and external, so you can migrate to the cloud, troubleshoot faster, and deliver exceptional user experiences. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/PacketPushers. And if you don't already have one, you can choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. And after the news, we talk to sponsor Codalime. They provide network engineering services, and we're going to discuss software-defined networking, or SDN, and whether SDN is a total revolution or just an evolution of the networks you know and love. All right, let's get to some news. Security vendor Fortinet has launched a new product called FortiAI Virtual Security Analyst. This is an on-prem malware detection appliance the company says uses a form of machine learning called deep neural networks to identify malware.
Lovely. I mean, that's like an SEO-rich product title right there.
Man.
FortiAI Virtual Security Analyst. That's like, what are we going to, you know, do you think they use machine learning to come up with a product name?
That's fantastic. Yes, I'm sure there is some machine learning algorithm spewing out marketing names. Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty, I think there's some, the quick review I did of this, I didn't get into deep, but I think you've got more information on this. But my initial sense of this is they called it AI and then said they actually used ML, machine learning, except they didn't use deep machine learning. They used a deep neural network, which is not actually machine learning. It's a deep learning thing. So I'd sort of want to call, like, this is the bloviation of marketing versus the reality. This isn't AI. This isn't machine learning. It's just deep learning, which is pretty straightforward these days, table stakes. So should be okay in the sense that deep learning is well understood because it's a mature technology, more or less. And also there's people around who know how to work it. Like, the problems with a lot of AI and a lot of ML is access to professionals who know how to, you know, operate and sustain that code is very rare.
Right.
What did you think it does?
So essentially, it's a box. It's an appliance on premise, a 2U box filled with NVIDIA GPUs, and you get your handy packet broker. You run traffic through it, and it tells you if it sees malware on your network. Unlike other systems that use deep learning or AI or whatever, it's not driven by the cloud. It's entirely on-premise. They say it can be air-gapped sensitive institutions. But essentially, a malware detection engine that they say has some deep learning neural network goodness. They say they've been training it in their lab for years and years, so it sort of comes out of the box ready to operate as opposed to having to train it over a period of time before it can start to function, but that it will also learn sort of the intricacies and interesting behaviors of your own network over time.
Okay, so that makes sense, because when you're programming deep learning, you want to throw the data through different learning paths.
Yep.
So you define a series of, they're saying here, neural networks, but these are entangled algorithms that simulate networking to look for relationships between data points.
Mm-hmm.
And the deep learning algorithms are actually not based on pre-learned data sets. So you actually just, if you know that this set of neural network mathematical algorithms gives you the desired outcome, then you can throw them at a consistent data set. The good thing about security data or networking data is it's often very constrained. Like, it's normalized, it's consistent, and often in the same format, like flow records and so forth. So it is does respond well to deep learning networks as I understand it.
Uh-huh.
So this makes sense, because then you can do it all on premises. And that's unique, because most of the other people are trying to do it in the cloud so they can sell it as a subscription service.
That's right.
So this is a real differentiator. If you want to do this on-prem, you don't like using third-party services that are outside your premises, you know, in the cloud where the data is given to other people or the value of the data is extracted, this gives customers a choice.
That's right. And I also, so you, because it's a Fortinet product, you can also send it feeds from your Fortinet firewalls. If you've got them on-premise as well, you can send it files, objects, and flows from any FortiGate firewalls that you have, but you don't have to. You can just use your own, whatever packet broker you've got in place, or, you know, just redirect traffic from a SPAN or TAP port to it. So I like the fact that they want to tie it into their security fabric. It is tied into their broader security fabric. If you want to do automated remediation, like quarantine a device or block a flow, but you don't have to. So it is a standalone, essentially, product.
Yeah. So this is that when you talk about their security fabric, this is the fairly widespread trend amongst security companies to stop just selling firewalls and saying that's what we do, and then other people will sell you accessories.
Yes.
We're seeing the security companies pick up the accessories and then bond them into their product and then call it a fabric. So it's not a fabric at all. It's basically a family of products that do different things. And so in this case, Fortinet's talking about having sandbox inspections, threat detection, insights, machine learning for web prevent web applications. Basically, it's not a fabric at all in the way that most people would think of it. It's just a series of products. Once upon a time, you would have brought them from a bunch of different vendors. Now you can buy them all from one vendor. And potentially that might simplify the deployment and operation. So this makes sense in that context.
Nice, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, Fortinet's very, I've always had the position that Fortinet generally likes selling hardware, where all the other security companies are moving into the subscription revenue and software and, you know, forcing customers to into a new direction that they may or may not want to go. Certainly, you know, we'll talk about more that more when we talk about Cisco down the line, but you know, being forced into subscriptions and recurring revenue isn't for everybody. So I quite like the way that Fortinet's sort of doing a bit of both, but mainly doing what they do well is always a good thing.
Yes. And they're essentially positioning this appliance as the equivalent of a SOC analyst. So someone who would be looking at files and malware day after day. The idea here is to automate it and also speed your identification and response if malware happens to get through your defenses.
Entirely credible. Yep.
Yep.
We'll see what the execution looks like, but with always, the bloviation in the marketing here. That
yes, I'm always, yeah. My hackles yeah. always go up when I see AI, deep learning, all that stuff. There can be a lot of potential marketing obfuscation, so take it with a grain of salt.
Yeah, it's clear that what they're actually doing is deep learning, but then they didn't hesitate to put machine learning and artificial intelligence into the whole mix here.
Well, it's right in the name, Forti AI.
That's it. And it's not, yeah. All right.
All right, moving on. VMware, they've announced a new bundled security suite for the data center. It's called VMware Advanced Security for Cloud Foundation. It bundles together Carbon Black for endpoint protection, a distributed firewall and IPS that you can customize to each workload or application, and a load balancer web app firewall that can also be distributed across workloads. The idea here is that you can customize rules and detection sets based on the individual workload. So for instance, if you're protecting an Apache workload, don't run all the signature set for Windows, et cetera. That the goal is to cut down on noise and false positives. The other idea is that, you know, VMware would love for you to get rid of all those hardware firewalls and IPSs and just run everything on x86.
So the diametric opposition to the Fortinet announcement.
Exactly.
It's all subscription. It's all cloud. It's only software. There's no hardware, you know. So, and it's also, however, from a business model, it's the same thing. It's this bundling of products.
Yes.
And VMware has been out buying a number of different security companies over the last, say, 3 or 4 years. Remember when they bought Platinum and turned that into AppDefense and so that you've got security inside of the VM and so forth and so on.
Right, and the load balancer is from Avi Networks, and that's what they're attaching the web app firewall to, yeah. And Carbon that's Black obviously was an acquisition.
Security acquisition. So what they're saying now is that security is part of the VMware suite, it's part of the bundle, if that's where you see your bundle. This is interesting because, as we'll talk down and later in the show, Palo Alto is having a tough time in the security market, and so is Checkpoint and a range of other security companies. They're not getting the growth and so forth. Mm-hmm. And my point would be is that companies like VMware, who are bundling the security into some piece of the infrastructure further underneath the stack, so instead of security being a separate thing like we used to see, you know, firewalls were separate and additional and you bought them from somewhere else. We've seen security bundled into the SD-WAN. We're now seeing it bundled into the data center operating system. So that's what VMware says. It's part of NSX. It's part of the VMware Cloud Foundation. And this bundling makes sense. And you can see from VMware's financial results, as we talk again later down the show, that's certainly working for them. And I think customers don't want to have dozens of suppliers, and getting rid of security suppliers is a positive.
I mean, they tell a very good story about don't hairpin it out to some appliance. Try to put the security controls as close to the workload as possible. And if you can customize the security defenses for that workload, to me that makes sense, particularly in terms of IPS when you don't want a lot of noise in the system. I do think there may be a drawback of having so many distributed security tools to keep track of and monitor and enforce policy on, but you're exchanging one problem for another.
Yeah, I think so, but the challenge with security has always been there's too much diversity in that market, too many tools across too wide of a spectrum. Mm-hmm. They didn't work together. You spent a lot of time as a customer bringing them all together to operate and deliver you useful intelligence. The bundling is an easy sell. It may not be the right thing to do, but it's an easy sell to say, oh, no, one supplier, we've got the SIEM, we've got the you know, the automatic, the neural networking stuff so that we can find and tell the threat intelligence type of stuff. Mm-hmm. We've got the web application, and it's all just one part. You just keep buying more of our products, and, you know, and from the vendor side, they land, once they're in through the door, they can keep expanding and keep expanding until, yeah.
Absolutely. Sticking with VMware, they also announced a new beta feature in their VMware Secure State product. Secure State maps the relationship between objects in your public cloud environments and looks for misconfigurations that would violate policy or expose resources. So this new beta lets you run agents in the cloud that will automatically fix any misconfigurations, or if you want to tie it into a DevOps or security workflow to get them fixed instead of doing it automatically.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right.
The idea here is everyone's talking about putting guardrails up in the cloud so that your developers have a sort of a safe environment to play in. That's following this storyline. And we also talked recently, two episodes back, about a similar product from TUFIN called, I believe, Secure Cloud, doing the same mm-hmm. thing, security configuration yep. analysis.
That's a big thing, because most of the weaknesses in cloud security have actually been self-inflicted. That is, customers in the cloud have failed to, you know, secure their S3 buckets, or, you know, made configuration flaws. And the use of tools that can find, and quite often these products are just enormously complicated. So using products that goes looking for known patterns makes good sense. I think at this point, fairly costly way of doing business to fix what, you know, it's not the cost that you have when you have a private network.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got a reason to keep stuff on premises, because all you're doing by going to the cloud is changing the problems that you have to face, and potentially solving the problems in the cloud is beyond your capability unless you retool, purchase new products, spend more money. That doesn't always make sense. So having tools like this makes sense.
Yeah, and I also like the fact that TUFIN and VMware make a point of saying, tie this into your DevOps workflow. So it becomes just sort of part of the regular process, as opposed to after the fact, oh crap, we got to go fix this.
I love that's so aspirational, Drew. That's just fantastic. Like, yeah, like DevOps is going to call a security function to make sure that's going to happen. They're barely able to get things done, much less worry about this type of stuff. All right.
Okay. Thanks for bursting my bubble. All right. Moving on. Bloomberg is reporting that Nokia is reviewing options, including a merger or asset sales, as the telecom company struggles with earnings. It suspended dividend payments last year and says it doesn't anticipate an earnings recovery until 2021 or 2022. The article quotes unnamed sources for this information.
Now, this is a narrative failure of huge proportions. Like, 5G is supposed to be the biggest big thing since big things were a thing, right?
Yes.
You know, and all of a sudden, you know, like we've had the US government bloviating about the fact that you can't use Huawei, and we've got to get an American. And here's Nokia, one of the big two Western suppliers of 5G. And really worldwide, there's only three. There's Nokia, Ericsson, and Huawei. And Nokia is saying financially they can't make money.
Right.
Largely in part because they're not going to be able to make money out of 5G until 2023, right? Early sales aren't until 2022. That's 2 years away. Mm-hmm. And revenue won't even have a substantial impact on revenue numbers until 2023. So just when you're listening to people bloviate on social media, you know, thought leaders and, you know, all those idiots, just remember that 5G is still 5 years away for any practical purposes. And the companies that are building 5G products are struggling for net financial viability. Like, Ericsson's not in great shape, and neither is obviously Nokia. I could make a case that this would be a nice play to get some US government money, like to get a nice subsidy. It's like, oh, we're in financial distress. You should so help us. I wonder if that's a factor here.
Well, I don't know if we talked about this, but in early February, the U.S. Attorney General, his name is Bill Barr, floated the idea of either the U.S. government or some private companies ponying up some money to invest in a controlling stake in a non-Huawei 5G provider. So that would be Nokia or Ericsson. Mm. So I think this is Nokia going, yoo-hoo, Mr. Barr.
Yeah, we could use some cheap cash. That would be really helpful, you know. Yes. Let's have a chat about getting free money. You know, I did wonder that.
Yeah.
That's a little bit whatever. But anyway, so Nokia is going to push ahead with some, according to the article from Bloomberg. Just keep in mind here that Bloomberg is a dodgy source for technology information. Remember the big hack that uh-huh. they've provided
about
no proof.
Supermicro, yeah.
Yeah, the Supermicro thing from way back. And we've got to take the source as highly dubious. But it is true that Nokia is struggling to financially to meet the sort of goals for its shareholders. So I think cynically, I think really this is a chance for Nokia to try and raise some funds on the cheap.
Yeah, I think so. I think the CEO is under serious pressure from activist investors. So by floating this story, they say, look, we take it seriously. We're trying to do something. And maybe by making this, letting this story out, some potential partners may show up and say, hey, let's start some conversations and maybe get something going. So it's an attempt by Nokia to say, look, we realize there's a problem. We're trying to take it seriously. And also signaling to potential investors or partners that there may be opportunities on the table.
Yeah. I think there's a long game being played here, but notwithstanding 5G is 5 to 10 years away, this is another proof point in that issue I keep raising.
All right, links in the show notes if you want to go read it about yourself. A quick break to tell you about our sponsor today, ThousandEyes. They help organizations deliver business-critical service by providing performance visibility and actionable intelligence from every user over any network to every app, including Office 365 and Salesforce. They have cloud agents, enterprise agents, and endpoint agents to gather unique insights on network behavior, topologies, and how they affect application performance. How can ThousandEyes help you? They can generate performance data through active monitoring techniques from global vantage points and quickly pinpoint the root cause of device faults, congestion, DDoS attacks, DNS failures, and more. You can share event dashboards, metrics, and visualizations with vendors and customers to work together to resolve problems. And here's a special offer for Packet Pushers listeners. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/Packet Pushers. Get that free account and a free ThousandEyes t-shirt while you're there. And thanks, ThousandEyes, for being a sponsor. Okay, here's an eye-opening milestone. Let's Encrypt, they provide free digital certs to domain owners, just recently issued its 1 billionth certificate.
That's a great milestone for Let's Encrypt. And also the people who are involved in starting Let's Encrypt should really take a bow. Cisco was one of the companies that gave the money to set up Let's Encrypt and to do this for free.
Mm-hmm.
So it's now a Linux Foundation project, of course, so it's not a bad thing. And I think overall this shows just how badly certificate authorities have failed people, that this business can be run for free and work successfully. It probably highlights how messed up the old SSL certificate market was back in the early days.
Yeah, they were really sticking the knife in their competitors in their blog post, because they said when they started with 11 people, and now they've scaled up to a billion certs issued with a staff of 13.
Which, that is really
mind-boggling. That is mind-boggling.
Yeah, that's right. Whereas if you look at, back in the day, all the certificate authorities were worth, at the peak of the boom in the 2000 in the dot-com era, mm-hmm. they were worth billions because they were going to be the key to security and all that sort
That's
of stuff.
Right. That's right. And
really, this proves that the original intention of certificate authorities back in the day was to validate the identity of the certificate holder, mm-hmm. in other words, validate the company that they were issuing their certificates for and that they were actually the people, and that they had the right to own a certificate for a given domain. So they would validate the domain. And the early certificate authorities never did that. Well, actually, that's not true. The early certificate authorities did. They used to make you send a fax and then they'd ring the phone number to check it. But at some point, everybody wanted to get in on the money because it was a highly profitable, lucrative business, massive profit margins, and there was a lot of politics around this. Every country wanted to own the certificate authority. So there was a while there where, you know, every country in the world wanted to build its own certificate authority so that they were in control of their own destiny.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those certificate authorities weren't well set up, didn't have the technology chops, didn't run the process very well. And pretty quickly, CAs just started to automate certificate. You could just click a button, send a certificate. It was like free money. It was like if you could charge $100 a year just to self-issue a certificate from a web interface, well, that was pretty easy. Yep. So, and the market pretty quickly, you know, this is a classic piece of capitalism kicking itself in the head. The certificates went from having real value by, you know, this belonged to a company and the company that it was issued to is actually a real thing and all that sort of stuff. And pretty quickly it became there was no value in certificates except as an encryption key. Mm-hmm. And so now we have Let's Encrypt issuing a billion certificates. Keep in mind, too, this is part of that very short life cycle. So Let's Encrypt only issues certs with a 3-month life cycle. So they people have to keep coming back and getting certs. So,
well, I guess that would help with their numbers then for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And remember last week we talked about Apple moving to a maximum 13-month timeline for the cycle, so that it can handle certificate revocation.
Yep. So Let's Encrypt is a nonprofit organization, and one of their missions is to drive the spread of HTTPS. The organization reports in its blog that 91% of page loads use HTTPS in the US, which is up from 64% in 2017. So they are having an effect.
Yeah. I think, and it all, because it's so automated and anybody can just do it, I wonder how many of those certificates are actually ever used in Angular. Like, be interesting to see a secondary analysis of how many of those billion certificates actually turned up online in a public network and how many were requested but never actually used and things like that. But still, I'm going to take the numbers for what it is. It's actually good for the industry because now we were able to implement TLS substantially because issuing certificates was free. There was no excuse not to. And now we have the internet using HTTPS or TLS encrypted flows for just about everything. I think it's a very high level of adoption.
Yeah, it's pretty good when you consider the potential complexity of certificates and encryption that they've had this kind of take up. All right, we got a bunch of financial results, so let's dive in. VMware, they've reported Q4 and full fiscal year financial results. The company broke the $10 billion annual revenue mark for the first time ever, and numbers were up all around. For Q4, the company had revenues of just over $3 billion, up 11% year over year, and net income of $321 million. For the full year, revenues were $10.81 billion, up 12% year over year, with a net income of $6.4 billion.
Yeah, so shares fell 3% due to the missed estimates. So people were, believing that VMware said they were going to be this number, and when they didn't, shares fell. That's not surprising. That's shares are some part of the share value is a predictor of future value, not current value.
Right.
So when you don't hit your numbers, shares drop a little bit. But still, 11% year over year growth is pretty astonishing from a company that's coming, still growing, and only sells software. So they're still able to sell software into the market.
I think it's particularly impressive given that as public cloud came on the horizon, folks thought, ooh, what's going to happen with VMware? And they have, I think, pivoted well to address the threat of cloud and also broken into other markets like data center security, data center networking, and WAN, SD-WAN. Right. So, yeah.
Yeah, vCloud was a miserable failure, I think. And they really missed their execution on that was pretty poor in hindsight. But Pat Gelsinger said revenue came in a bit short of expectations due to a higher mix of subscription and SaaS. So subscription revenues mean you can't book all the revenue up front. You have to book it as it arrives.
Yep.
And then he said, as well as linked quarter deal execution challenges, which is management speak for our deals didn't close.
Right. We were supposed to sell it last quarter, but we didn't. Yes.
Yeah. So basically they weren't able to get deals executed. Now, this is where you start thinking about what is it that's causing customers to delay those decisions or to have execution challenges. And I think we're probably looking at the general downturn. We've been talking about a generalized slowdown in enterprise IT spending. It's been shrinking about 5% per quarter. We've seen all the major vendors shrinking, like Cisco's shrinking at around about 4% to 5% per quarter. Revenues are dropping quite substantially. They're maintaining profitability, but revenue is slowing for all of the traditional vendors. And you could also say point at COVID or coronavirus and start to say that's starting to have an impact here. If you're a company and you're looking at COVID and you think, do I really need to perform this upgrade? Should I delay these decisions? Because if this has an impact on the market. And over the last month, we've seen people saying there's going to be a downturn of anywhere from 6 to 25%. So IDC published some numbers this week saying PC sales will be down 9% in their prediction for 2020, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think some of this is going, we'll see in all the financial results down across the board. And I think coronavirus is certainly a part of this.
There's certainly also going to be supply chain challenges given all of the disruption to the manufacturing and assembly that happens in China and that essentially being slowed down or shut down significantly because of the virus outbreak. Yeah, so the next time we talk about financial results, it's going to be a different picture.
It's going to be interesting because the software companies aren't going to be impacted. So VMware, Nutanix, they're not affected because they're just about software only. Uh-huh. But companies like Dell, weirdly, because of the US-China trade war, a lot of the companies were shifting their manufacturing away from China. Uh-huh. And they may actually be able to lean into that process and the impact may be less horrible, if you like.
Could be. I'm curious. That kind of manufacturing development ramp up takes some time. And yes, they got maybe a head start with the trade wars. It may probably accelerate because of the virus outbreak, but the whole Asia region is also impacted. So I don't know that there'll be knock-on effects.
Well, so far it's limited to China and Hong Kong. So China, Vietnam, Taiwan, those types of countries are all handling it quite well. It'll have to wash out. We'll see. But I'm just sort of making the point that, the trade war that started earlier last year has seen a lot of vendors reevaluate their supply chains.
Yes.
And start the diversity process. So yes, we are, you know, 3 to 6 months down that pathway.
Right. And I anticipate that diversity process now takes on additional.
But imports, if you're a software company, you know, if you get a coronavirus inside of your development team, so if you've got a high-rise building full of developers and COVID gets in there, yeah, your shipping timelines might get really...
Right, although you can also just send everybody home and they can work from home, assuming they're set up for that. So, moving on. Nutanix also released results for the second quarter of fiscal 2020. The company had revenues of $346.8 million, which is a slight improvement year over year, but they're still not profitable. They had a net loss of $217.6 million, which is almost $100 million more than it lost at this time last year.
Yeah, Nutanix is... I'm sort of fascinated by Nutanix because they're now sitting on nearly $2 billion worth of accrued losses with a $1.2 billion annual run rate. So they're currently sitting on debt that's nearly twice their total run rate. Mm. They make no profits. They're still making $900 million a year in losses. Oof. So on $1.2 billion of revenue, they're making $900 million losses.
They're losing $900 million of it. Wow.
So that's really substantial. So this is not a profitable company. Whereas other companies are certainly profitable, the share price value and the books are built on the fact that Nutanix must grow at a substantial rate to justify dragging that debt along behind it. And there's nothing wrong with the Nutanix business. It has increased sales. It's got increased customer numbers. They are big about talking about increased number of customers and the movement to subscription licensing ahead of sales and their reduction on dependent of hardware sales. So they're partnering with Dell to sell the hardware and their move away from selling the hardware. I mean, they say puts them in a better place. But, you know, sales of marketing is at 90% of revenue. So, you know, they're selling at $1.2 billion, but their sales and marketing is like 90% of that.
Wow.
And the losses, of course, are service and support, R&D, you know, various bits and pieces of other costings. So while their sales story is really good, I think their long-term execution could be hampered by the fact if they suddenly lose growth, and as we talked about before, coronavirus, downturn in enterprise IT spending, although Nutanix is certainly a cheaper option than VMware. Mm-hmm. So if you're somebody looking to, you know, have a VMware-like solution but at a better price, Nutanix might have something for you. But yeah, still a lot of unanswered questions to Nutanix. It's still a gamble in my mind.
That's right. And speaking of coronavirus, they are warning of a softer Q3 due in part, they say, to reduced activity in AJP because of coronavirus. So,
yeah, I think that'll be
expect to hear a lot of that.
Just doesn't make sense. I mean, just, you know, $2 billion worth of losses on $1.2 billion worth of revenue and still losing $900 million a year at the $900 million run rate. This is not a profitable company. And if the, you know, coronavirus really gets out of hand, then they could be in significant trouble.
Cisco has announced that employee layoffs will be coming. It did not say how many workers would be let go.
A report here from Wall Street Journal saying that Cisco told the Wall Street Journal part of an ongoing process of aligning our investment. We talked recently about Cisco's financial numbers. They came in shrinking at 4%. Cisco usually shrinks 3 to 5% in any given quarter. And as they shrink, they cut headcount. So this is your two things. One, this is business as usual. Cisco regularly cuts headcount at this time of the year. Usually it's Christmas in the middle of the year, so this is an extra one. And it's your regular reminder that working for a vendor is not necessarily the friendliest place to be. If you like steady employment, then a customer might be a better choice.
Yeah, I kind of feel like we could just record a 2-minute or a 30-second snippet and just save it and drop it in a couple times a year about Cisco.
Yeah. My sense of this is that Cisco's down 5%, so they're going to cut 5% of heads to match the staff count to the revenue. They're not going to look after their employees or care about them at all. So.
All right, our last story for the day, Palo Alto Networks reported its latest quarter results. They had revenues of $816.7 million, up 15% year over year, but a net loss of $73.7 million, and the company is planning to spend $1 billion to buy back shares.
Another company or reporting earnings cuts, not only in the next quarter, but also restating their full financial year results, which led to the shares falling 13%. Like Nutanix, Palo Alto is a company that's very highly leveraged and based on growth. That said, they did have a 17% increase in billings year over year. So they are growing. but there's some weakness here. So at the end of the day, after they announced the results, JP Morgan and RBC downgraded the stock from a buy to a hold. And that saw any, you know, any value, future value in the shares was taken away. And the market has obviously decided that 13% of their share price value was tomorrow's value. So they put that in the bin, and not good for Palo Alto employees. The CEO said in the financial results, we are executing well on our transformation, but becoming more relevant to our customers and building a third leg to our security business is the hardest thing to do. So what they're alluding to there is, as Palo Alto stops being a firewall company and starts to become a firewall bundle or security bundle, you know, the threat intelligence, they're obviously struggling to make that transition. And we just talked about how VMware's done it, and Palo Alto sort of highlighting how difficult it is for them to make that. And that's why they're missing their execution. But one way to hold the share price up is to announce an accelerated share buyback. So they've obviously got some cash in the bank.
$1 billion. Yeah.
They're spending $1 billion to buy back shares, which will keep the share price inflated and keep them from it. And I also noted in the discussion that they're now shipping their SD-WAN announcement, and they've had some early sales. If anybody out there has looked at their Palo Alto SD-WAN, I'd be interested to get your feedback. If you go to packetpushers.net/FU, just tell me, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, how well did it do for you? Was it, or if you've got anything that you want to say, I'd love to chat to you about it and find out some more about the Palo Alto SD-WAN. It'd be interesting to hear what people's experiences are.
I've been wondering about the effect of SD-WAN on Palo Alto. We talk to customers regularly who say, yeah, we had a bunch of Palo Alto boxes out at our branches and we're slowly getting rid of them, either because we're going to use the firewall capabilities in the SD-WAN device, or we're going to use a CASB or a SASE or whatever and just run traffic through a cloud-based security filter as opposed to a box.
Yeah, my sense of it is that if you don't use Palo Alto just as a firewall, it's much more, if you've got, once you've got an SD-WAN, the need for a firewall changes.
Yep.
And as I've always said, an SD-WAN appliance gives you is a firewall.
Yep.
It's an application-grade firewall with the visibility tooling.
Yep.
Why do you need a Palo in front of your SD-WAN edge? And, you know, there are SD-WAN products that actually have full security functions that displace the need for any sort of commercial security product, you know, any third-party or add-on product. And, yeah, I would see a lot of displacement for the traditional security vendors. And that'll, Palo Alto feels like it's catching up in this particular area. They've been very successful, you know, running Linux on ARM. They've got really cheap hardware, so they've been able to make good profits and get good growth by focusing on the GUI and the usability of their product. Mm-hmm. But I feel like they might be falling a little bit behind. It's worth keeping in mind that at $816 million in revenue, they are just a little bit larger than Cisco, which sells about $790 million of security a quarter.
You mean in the security business?
In the security business. So Palo Alto is only as big as Cisco is, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not exactly a runaway success in this space.
Yeah, well, we'll keep an eye on Palo going forward, but that does wrap up all of our news for this episode. Please stay tuned for our sponsored Tech Bytes conversation with Codaline. We'll be talking about SDN. That's coming right up. Welcome to Tech Bytes, a 15-minute podcast on compelling technologies and products. Our sponsor today is Codalime, which provides network engineering services, and we're going to discuss software-defined networking, aka SDN. Is SDN a total revolution or just an evolution of the networks you know and love? Our guest is Monica Antoniak. She is head of R&D at Codalime. Monica has 15 years experience working for telecoms and service providers. She works hands-on with top-tier telcos on a daily basis. And at Codalime, she manages a team of experts that link research and development and professional services. Monica, welcome to the podcast. Can you get us started with a few words about what Codalime does?
So hello. So first, thank you for having me here. So a few words about Codalime. So Codalime is network engineering specialist company. So we basically provide expert teams to just take on more advanced networking problems and have expertise in tungsten fabric, network testing, and basically building customized solutions. So actually, we help our clients with building software products from end to end. So we start with the UX design, so front end, back end, deployment. But what we also do is the automation and professional services and actually support of the product. So basically, if you're struggling with your network engineering problem, so this is something we can help with.
So Codalime is a professional services organization that can come along and help you with your SDN platform, not so much in terms of selling your product, but in terms of making it work for you?
Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay. See, that's important because oftentimes we're talking to vendors and they've got a thing to sell you and they don't always talk to you about how to make it useful, how to make it operate. And really that requires people to do that last bit. And that's what your core business is about.
Yes. So this is exactly what we do. We do, but we also help to integrate, to deploy, we support with your maintenance, not just sell a specific product.
Okay. And you focus on enterprises and service providers?
Yes, we basically target both of them.
So we want to talk today about SDN. It may seem like a radical departure from traditional networking, but your position is that SDN adoption doesn't mean throwing out everything that you know about networking. So can you get into that? Explain what you mean?
Basically, from our experience and from our point of view, the SDN are not really the evolution, not the revolutions of the network. So basically, if you take a look at the SDN and you take a look at the traditional networks, so it doesn't mean if you want to go into the SDNs, it doesn't mean you have to throw away everything you know and you have already. So from our point of view, the SDN is just the evolution of what you already have. So I will not go into the details what is the SDN because it has been explained many times here. And besides, there's no a single definition.
Right.
But the SDNs are not to replace existing network, but actually they allow for adding a value to what you already have. So you basically take the ideas that are here, that are used, that were excelled over the years, you add automation to it, and you're in a good position just to discuss the SDNs and those kind of stuff.
Okay, so you're saying if I'm familiar with data center switching and routing and been operating a network, I don't have to throw all that away just because now I'm bringing in maybe a fabric and some automation on top of that.
No, you just have to build on what you already have. Basically, that's it.
One of the interesting things that we've talked about a lot, Drew, is that a lot of people get an SDN controller, and that is 80% of what they need. But there's room for this 20% of extra stuff, of automation that you do that's specific to your business and the way your team work. And this is where CodeLime, you know, when we're talking and prepping for the show, it's about getting that extra automation. And if you haven't got that, maybe you want to talk to CodeLime so you can get that automation done and find a partner to help you do it.
So yeah, basically this is what we do, because if you take a look at the SDN, basically if you take a look at any kind of deployments, you have the 80% that is quite common, but what you also need is the customization. And that customization part is something that we can do for you.
Yeah. So the way that I like to think about this is that if you've got a network and you're running something like Tungsten Fabric or VMware, and you need to want to bring the two together so that the thing that happens with one happens in the other, so the networks connect together and you want the automation to happen, that's not something that the companies that sell you the products can do. You need to do that yourself, and you might need professional services. Is that the sort of thing CodeLime's going to do?
Yes, exactly. This is what we do. We actually make some kind of audits. I would say we take a look what's already there. We take a look where you want to go, what you want to achieve, what's your target. And we actually try to propose a migration step to make it kind of seamless, not to make, a revolution. We just want to make a migration as easy as it is so you can have what you want to achieve, but in a, let's say, easy and peaceful way.
Easy and peaceful sounds nice.
Yes.
So let's talk a little bit about SDN benefits. If I'm sort of considering SDN, what am I going to get operationally out of moving to this model?
Basically, if we take a look at the SDN, normally I would say that there are three main areas that we can actually discuss about the SDN adoption and SDN benefits. So the first are, of course, in the one wide area networks, which we actually leverage the concept of, let's say, distinguished control plane and data plane. We have the control plane and data plane separation, which is basically something that is well known from the traditional networks, because if you take a look at the traditional, say, carrier grade routers, what you have is the control cards that are completely separate from the line cards. So this concept is already there, is present. What we gain by actually having the SDN and adding the SDN controllers is that we have like a brain which is completely separated from the forwarder, so from the muscles, and we have and we can take a look at the, let's say, helicopter view of the network. So we make really reasonable decisions. So we actually can take a look at the network. We can make a smart decision with the controllers. We can intelligently route traffic. So you basically gain the concept of using your resources better. So this is something that you can do for the wide area network. So with the DC, if you take a look at the DC example, when you normally and traditionally had the switches and one flat L2 domain, mm-hmm. and then you go into the SDN. So again, you import the well-known protocols from the network, like BGP, like EVPN. When you use VXLAN, when you introduce the concept of overlay and underlay networks, then again, what you have better resiliency because you have multipath and it works. you have better, again, resource usage. So you have, in that case, a resilient network. So this is your gain. You don't have to waste your resources because all of it is used. You don't have to play with the old-fashioned protocols. And there's the newest approach, the third area, I would say, is when we are working with the virtualized stuff like VMs, like containers. So then we can use the controllers to create the virtual networks. So once we integrate the SDNs with the platforms like OpenStack, like Kubernetes, so this is easy way to use your compute power. This is efficient way to create the network. So in that case, Tungsten Fab is a quite good example of that solution. And there's yet another angle of the SDN, which is not that very focused on the networking itself, but we can also take a look at the programmable network devices, and those programmable network devices are done by users. So normally and traditionally, as we all know, we have the vendor-based box, which is like fixed, and there's not much you can do about it. This is also, of course, not true, because what you can do, right? You can use on some of them some scripts, and you can do it. But here we are talking about the programmable chips. So if you want to have a feature, a new feature, which is definitely customized for you. And by the way, this is something we can also do for you.
So you look at things like P4 and being able to program directly in the switch if there's something specific in your niche that you want to do. But I think this is the way to think about this, I think, is that you're going to use an SDN platform for most of your networking, but sometimes there's a specific thing that you want to do, and maybe P4. I think particularly service providers would want that, wouldn't they?
Yes, exactly, because there's something you need, because this is very specific to your need, to your network, and you will not ask the vendor to do it for you, because even if they agree, it will take a while and you need it right now. Your time to market matters. So you need to have it faster.
The big vendors take 6 months to a year to add a feature or function if they don't have it. And then maybe they won't even support it going forward.
I also want to go, were you making a reference to Whitebox when you're talking about being able to do more customization in your network, meaning I can buy my hardware and my network operating system software separately?
So something like that, yes, but it's not only the network hardware, because if you discuss the smart NICs, there are smart NICs that also can be programmable by for example, before there are FPGAs that are programmable. So we can do also that, because it's not only the network devices, but you can also do it on the computes when you have the line cards, the NICs, and you need to add some specific features to that.
Okay, so I think this is an important point then. So you're saying with Codalime, I can sort of do a plain vanilla SDN. But you guys can also come in, and if there's some very specific use cases that I have where I need to get into the guts of programming an ASIC with P4 or programming FPGAs, you guys can help me do that.
Yes, that's what we do.
Okay. So maybe we should talk a little bit more specifically. You mentioned Tungsten Fabric, and that's a platform that you've had some success with and you're very comfortable with.
Yes, one of our things that we work with. So basically, and this is the exact definition that is being used. So Tungsten Fabric is an open source network and security orchestrator which provides secure connectivity for cloud native environments. But basically, to put it in simpler words, so Tungsten Fabric is a way you can manage your network, your both physical and virtual resources. So you can use it to implement service chaining if you need it. You do your network connectivity dynamically in an automated way. You can assure the separation of traffic of the different tenants. So this concept, the Tungsten Fabric, the solution is very, I would say, easy for a network person to understand, because basically it uses the same concept that are used in traditional networks. There's a BGP protocol, there are VRFs, there are MPLS labor, this is VXLAN, so there's nothing new from the network perspective. So it's actually very, very easy to understand, to get to know the design, the architecture, the way it works for a network engineer. That's why we love it, basically.
Okay, so if I'm bringing in Tungsten Fabric, as you mentioned, I'm going to be able to still use BGP, VXLAN, tools and protocols that I'm familiar with. It's not starting from scratch with this. With Tungsten Fabric, it's not making me go outside of my comfort zone.
Yes, but let's be honest. There are differences. There are some design things that differs, but basically you work on that. You use BGP, use MPLS. So you understand the concept from day one, because they are not something completely new.
Okay. And is Tungsten Fabric targeted at the data center or the wide area network or both?
So basically, what Tungsten Fabric targets, what you can actually do is, I would say the data center is the first or let's say most common use case. So you can actually play with the virtual resources. You can create virtual network. There's also a way you can play with the fabric. Although, to be honest, the most common use case is using the Tungsten Fabric to play with the virtual resources.
And by virtual resources, you're talking about VMs, containers, that kind of thing?
Actually, both of them, because the Tungsten Fabric works with a different platform. So this is the same for OpenStack or for Kubernetes. So even if you want to do some kind of migration from one to the other, or you want to interconnect one to the other, so what you can actually do, you can use Tungsten Fabric to it. We even had a demo on one of the conferences. So yeah, this is something what you can do. And actually, when you're using Tungsten Fabric, you can do something like this, let's say, in an easy way at your own pace.
So you mentioned Tungsten Fabric is open source. Do you have a sense of how well it's supported? Because I know sometimes folks are a little bit wary about embracing open source because they might be worried about support. They might be worried about the project going away. So what is your sense around Tungsten Fabric and its viability?
So from our perspective, the Tungsten Fabric for the moment is quite successful. So it has a community that supports it. There's a lot of new things coming around the Tungsten Fabric, so we can play with it. It's used right around the world, so you can use this. If you can take a look at the different versions of the Tungsten Fabric, there are different ones. So yeah, you can actually play with it, and also because this is open source, you can actually see what's inside, how it works, how it looks like. You can contribute to it if you want yourself.
Well, Monica, I think we're at about the end of our time, but thank you for joining us. Thank you to Cody Lime for being a sponsor. And if folks are interested in finding out more about you, what you do, and how to get in touch with you, where would you send them?
So thank you again for having me here. So for more information about Cody Lime, the things we do, the things we have, just go to the website. So it's codylime.com and you can find everything right there.
Okay, it's codylime.com. It's CODILIME, codylime.com. Thank you to Cody Lime for being a sponsor. And thank you to you for being a listener. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. You can follow us on Twitter at packetpushers, find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.